Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. Welcome back to the Table Talk podcast. I'm here with two of our fabulous farm to table pharmacists and one that has not been on the podcast yet. So I'll let her introduce herself first. Dr. Katie Johnston is in Maine. So she is the furthest north, I think, of our team. And so why don't you give us a little bit of background about you, Katie?
Sure. Thank you, Melody, for having me today. Again, my name is Dr. Katie Johnstone, or Dr. Katie J. I live in Portland, Maine. So yes, we are very north and it's very cold, but you know, getting through. And I'm excited to be here today to talk about nutrition and all things controversy of food.
Yes.
It seems like you need a master's degree these days to feed yourself, right? Which is true.
Exactly. So, yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So we're definitely talking about nutrition today. I should have said that already. And then Lindsay is back with us. So Lindsay, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I am Dr. Lindsay Dalton. I am in Ohio, and yeah, I'm super excited to talk about nutrition and just debunk all of the crazy stuff that we've been told in the past.
Awesome. Yes. So the reason we're talking about nutrition is because this is probably the most confusing topic for patients. And even aside from functional medicine, I think about my time in family medicine and I have patients come in and say, well, one doctor told me not to eat eggs. This doctor told me that I need to go plant-based. This doctor said I have to get rid of my sugar. And this doctor said I need to go low salt. And so when they get all of that information, it's all very confusing to them. And then they just give up. You know, once it becomes so confusing and it's hard to navigate, then they just say, I'm just going to eat whatever I want and not actually make those changes. So we thought that giving some time today to discuss nutrition and really why we are where we are might be a good place to start. And we welcome questions after the podcast for specific things on nutrition that you want to talk about. And it's probably going to be more of an overarching discussion. But one of the things we know, that 250 million Americans are obese, over 1 in 10 people in America have type 2 diabetes. And so because of that and the inflammation that's created from high blood sugars in the body, we have a number one killer in our country is heart disease. So it's not actually the high blood sugars that kill patients, it's the heart disease. And certainly heart disease can be caused from other types of inflammation too. So we've got the dysregulated blood sugar, but we've also got other inflammatory patterns based on a lot of things related to nutrition and our lifestyles. So because of that, we as functional medicine providers really want to get to the root cause of what's causing inflammation in the body. We know that patients are taking high blood pressure medicines, cholesterol lowering medications to do that. But in some cases, those may be warranted, especially when we think about those high risk patients that either have, you know, family history of early heart attack or stroke, or they've had one themselves and we're trying to prevent a second one. There may be times where certainly medications might be a piece of the plan, but we also have to realize that nutrition is a huge piece too. And so that's really what we're going to talk about today. So why don't one of you tell us what the standard American diet is? Because we always talk about the SAD diet, but sort of define that for our audience.
Okay. When I think standard American diet or SAD diet is basically food-like substances or ultra-processed foods that, you know, majority of people consume every day. Stuff with a lot of sugar, like sodas and muffins, and maybe things that aren't so obvious, like cereal, and even health promoting foods like those smoothie drinks. You know, those are full of sugar, and kind of just even the standard American lifestyle that goes along with the diet. You know, we're rushing, we're not sitting down to eat, or in our car eating, and just distracted most of the time, which affects, you know, how you absorb food and how your body utilizes it as well.
Right. Yes. And even yogurts, you think like yogurt is a healthy thing, it's cultured, but then most of the yogurts either have a lot of sugar in it if they're not plain, or might even have artificial sweeteners that can cause some problems like insulin resistance and things too. So plain yogurt may be a great option, but the majority of yogurt consumed in the country isn't like that. So there's a lot of things here. And it's interesting. I watched, so last night I was traveling back from Denver on a plane in the evening, and I was like, it's too late for me to work. I just need to watch something on the back of this TV screen. And I watched a documentary on Julia Childs. And was talking about, you know, she went to war, she went to help in the military, and then she went to France and she learned how to cook. And she started to write recipes for people down, and she would send them back to America and have her sister do them and figure out if it was right. And it was really one of the first times there was really good instruction giving to recipes. A lot of times recipes were just throw this in and throw this in, but she had very detailed instructions on how to do these things. And the first publisher that actually was contacted her about putting together a book said, oh, no, Americans don't want this. The American women in the 60s and 70s, they don't want this because they want something convenient. They need something they can just open and not have to do all these instructions. And so historically, that is really what has happened, is that Americans were fed this information that here's the box that's convenient to do this, and here's the can, and here's the frozen vegetables. And if you go, you know, to other countries, and I was even talking to my driver to the airport yesterday, and he's from Morocco, and he was saying that when he came to America, he couldn't believe like how much was stored in the freezer. And, you know, which the frozen food aren't necessarily bad, and when it comes to vegetables, but when it comes to the other things we're putting in the freezer, it can be. He said when he lived in Morocco, the only thing you put in your freezer was ice and water and things like that, because they got fresh food from the market. You know, they went to the market every day. And so when we think about this SAD diet, it started years ago as far as this idea that food was convenient and that food didn't need to be fresh and nourishing to our bodies. And then as the American culture has gotten more and more busy and this busyness has taken over, that has just continued. Thankfully, there is our generation has taken that back a little bit. And interestingly, that whole Julia Childs thing, she was one of the first people to go on TV and teach people how to cook. And then that turned into all these cooking shows. And now we have Instagram to teach us how to eat, or TikTok and all of these things. So we really have moved more into this, okay, we do want to nourish our bodies, and people are interested in information about this, when before it was something we didn't really talk about. So it's interesting, the history of that in the United States. And I know, Katie, you brought up this thing about Dwight Eisenhower. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So in 1955, President Eisenhower had a heart attack, and that kind of led for this big push for heart healthy eating. And there's one person in particular who was very outspoken, Ansel Keys, and he was a physiologist, and he had some data that was not so great, a lot of cherry picking. And kind of pushed and insisted that it was saturated fat that was to blame for heart disease. And so that's how we kind of got to cholesterol being the main culprit for causing heart disease, and the push to lower cholesterol at all costs. And so then, you know, when you have something like that, you have food companies that get on the low fat, fat free. So that was us in the 90s and the 80s. And so once you pull fat out from food, it has to have some kind of taste. So in floods the sugar, you know. And so then we had high fructose corn syrup, which is super cheap and really easy to use. It gives it a long shelf life. And then you have margarine, you know, can't believe it's not butter, right? Which are those trans fats that are now banned for causing heart problems and heart attacks. So that's kind of how we got to where we are in our food pyramid, which has like the bottom of it, 6 to 12 servings of grains, which there's a difference between a whole grain and bread and pasta and bagels and things like that, and how you respond to that.
Sure.
So that's, you know, how we got here.
It's interesting because now, you know, looking at the functional medicine picture, we do know that saturated fat does increase our intestinal permeability. And even I was recently at an A4M conference last weekend, and one of the nutrition speakers was talking about even sometimes coconut oil can be more likely to increase LPS, which is a you know, byproduct of bacteria in our gut that can cause this inflammation. But the idea here was that they took out every fat. It wasn't just saturated fats and those bad fats. And not that saturated fat is all the time bad, but we do have to balance that. But this idea that even olive oil and things like that weren't to be healthy anymore, that we had to remove all of the fat. And then what we replaced it with probably was more of the problem than just actually reducing it to begin with. Like you said, with the products. One of the things that comes to mind there is fructose. So fructose is the leading cause of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I think about they banned trans fat. Like, why haven't we gotten to a point where we know that this is the cause of this fatty liver deposits, but we haven't gotten to a point where the country is banning that from our food supply. And part of it is the fructose itself is a natural compound. So it's sort of hard to ban that because we eat bananas and we eat other things with fructose. But this idea that we're going to have more and more fructose by doing this high fructose corn syrup that is really linked to this fatty liver is something that, you know, blows my mind. But we know there's a lot of money involved in lobbying and things like that with food regulations, which is challenging when some of the largest companies in the United States that are supporting the government are involved. So that's all we're going to say about that. But yeah, we definitely, you know, have to
another podcast.
Yeah. Hopefully no one from those companies is listening. So as far as the food pyramid, you mentioned that. So that has been sort of turned upside down a little bit in the last few years and turned into this plate method where we see, you know, different images are a little bit different, but they do have, you know, vegetables as part of your plate, protein as part of your plate, and some area for carbohydrates. So it's a little bit more balanced, but then they still have this like drink on the side and this yogurt, you know, dessert thing on the side. So I always try to simplify it for people. Like, don't worry about those extra things, like drink water and focus on filling half of your plate with non-starchy vegetables and a corner of your plate protein, and then put your carbs in another corner. It makes it easier than counting all these things. But Lindsay, do you just want to give us an overview of all the different diet programs out there and sort of explain maybe what each of those consist of, or a couple of them?
Yeah, there are so many, especially now. It's just, I understand why people are so confused, because we're just constantly bombarded by the next new way to eat, when honestly, all you have to do is put food in your mouth and learn to eat. So keto, super popular, especially right now. And that is where you limit your carbohydrates a lot to get your body into a state of ketosis, which basically means instead of your body burning the carbohydrates for fuel, your body switches and starts burning fat for fuel. And so that is super popular right now, great for weight loss, and many other different things. Vegan, you're going to be cutting out animal protein, all animal products. So eggs, dairy, anything that comes from an animal, you're going to be cutting it out.
Even honey.
Even honey, yes.
Like from bees, they still live too. I don't know why that's bad.
Vegetarian, not as restrictive. They're just taking out the actual animal proteins. Still can have the dairy and the eggs. And then paleo, that is eliminating the grains. So not having the oats and the rice and the things like that. There's also like the fasting diet, which we can get into maybe later. Lots of other variations of low carb diet. But yeah, just so many different options to choose from.
Yes, yes. So the Mediterranean diet is this one that has been the most well studied across the literature as far as anti-inflammatory and helping with sort of this heart disease risk reduction. So that's really full of rich fruits and vegetables that are high in fiber, those healthy fats like the olive oil, nuts and seeds. It does include whole grain. So again, the whole grain is going to break down differently than these quick, you know, processed grains. So it takes a little bit longer for the body to process. The blood sugar doesn't spike as much. It helps support the microbiome. And then there's lots of herbs and spices in Mediterranean cooking. And then we have fish and poultry are eaten as part of that. And really red meat is not a huge part of the Mediterranean diet or the typical Mediterranean, you know, diet. I think as the world has sort of immigrated to the Mediterranean coast, there's more red meat consumption maybe than there was originally. But in general, the fish and the poultry are bigger parts of their diet. And certainly sweets are limited. So you can definitely see how that contrasts to the standard American diet, where a lot of people are eating fast food and they're picking up snacks and things like that from vending machines and things throughout the day and really not getting those nourishing foods. And so much of this comes back to what we're feeding our microbiome and how that's responding to different hormone signals. So I think maybe in one of our discussions of diabetes before, we talked about how there are the good bacteria in our gut actually make something called short chain fatty acids. And those fatty acids feed the colon cells. And then they also start signaling the insulin process and tell the pancreas to make insulin, tell you you're full. So people that are just like, I'm eating and eating and eating and I'm not full, something is broken in that process, whether it's the microbiome or a deficiency in certain bacteria that are helping to provide those hormone signaling. So it's super interesting because your gut is really an endocrine organ in a way that it's actually starting to signal your hormones to tell you you're full and help your pancreas to secrete insulin. So the challenge with some of these diets is that we pull out things that might be feeding the microbiome. So we talk about keto, and while keto can be done in a Mediterranean style where we do, you know, good fruits and vegetables and more limited fruits, but still some berries, and then also doing those healthy fats, that can be great. But when we're talking about keto and making sure we're getting those nourishing non-starchy vegetables in that keto, you know, diet, because those vegetables do have a small amount of carbohydrates, but not enough to really make a huge difference. But then when we talk about keto, what we see sometimes on Instagram and TikTok, we see the bacon and eggs all day and maybe protein shakes with coconut milk bombs or, you know, something where there's just lots and lots and lots of fat. And while, again, like fat, if you're eating fat, you're burning fat, yes. But at the same time, like, what is that doing to the diversity in the microbiome? And we have just so much literature every day. I feel like we're still just on the tip of the iceberg sometimes with the microbiome literature, and we still have so much to discover. But what we do know is that diversity is key. And if we remove those, you know, foods that feed the good bacteria, then we're really going to be challenged with other health issues later on. So certainly vegetarian diets are going to be great, but you can also be a vegetarian that's focused on these foods that are rich in vegetables, but you can also eat like a pizza with vegan cheese, and you can find these vegetarian type substitutes. And the same thing goes for gluten-free. We can have a healthy gluten-free diet that's focused on the vegetables, or we can have pastries that are gluten-free and donuts that are gluten-free and all those things throughout the week as well. So it's really comes back to every single one of these diets comes back to this core of, we need non-starchy vegetables. We need colorful fruits and plants in our diet and those healthy oils as a foundation. And then when we do that 80% of the time, we're going to have the nutrients that we need. So there's lots of discussion of eating the rainbow. I mean, it's so funny. My grandmother came from sort of the hills of Kentucky and Harlan County, and her dad was a coal miner. And so they lived that life that you ate canned food. Some of the things they grew, but a lot of it was corn-based and things like that. And a lot of boxed things, they were taught that things were convenient. But I had served her purple carrots one time, and she was like, "What the heck are these? I've never seen a purple carrot in my life." And except maybe she didn't say heck. But so it was just so funny, like, to see, like, we're trying to incorporate these fruits and vegetables, but they really weren't available to them. I really hadn't seen a purple carrot until maybe after college, maybe in this rainbow carrot world. Yeah. So the country is really taking back a lot of this poor information that they were taught before, which is really cool to see. And even these food meal services, you see people getting these fresh boxes delivered to cook meals that are, people are trying to make the cooking of your meal from scratch convenient too, and making that, you know, available for families. And certainly there's good and bad services. Different ones are maybe more healthy ingredients than others, but we're not talking about that today. But I do think, I love that the movement of America has been recently to sort of take back this misinformation that we were taught for so long. So why don't we talk about carbs? So whoever wants to start talking about carbs, Lindsay, maybe.
Yeah, I can talk about carbs. So yeah, I think a lot of people are scared of carbs with all, I mean, I remember even being in high school when the Atkins diet was huge. Yep. And now it's like keto is huge. So people really do start fearing carbs, and they think just all carbs are bad, right? So what happens is they start cutting out things like fruits that are super beneficial, packed with so many vitamins, nutrients, antioxidants, And our bodies need those. And I've even heard people say, like, oh, I'm on the keto diet, but I really want some fresh strawberries. And I just want to shake them. And I'd be like, eat the strawberries. They're so good for you. So, gosh, it's so sad that people like feel like they have to fear food when there's so many benefits to these foods that they're fearing. And it's really just these highly refined, highly processed food that doesn't even look like food that comes from nature that we're talking about when we say to limit carbs. It's the bread, it's the muffins, it's the bagels, all those things. It's not the fresh fruit. It's not the even the starchy vegetables like sweet potatoes, squash, like eat it. It's so good for you.
Yeah. And I would say too, if like, it also depends, obviously we're talking about in generalizations. And as we talk about individuals, people with metabolic syndrome, people that maybe aren't processing sugar very well because their body is insulin resistant, maybe need to avoid some of the fruits, maybe like the high starchy bananas and pineapple and mango, but they can have the low glycemic index fruits as far as berries and blueberries and strawberries and figuring that out. But no one should be completely taking fruit out of their diet because of what Lindsay said, as far as the antioxidants and all of those things. So certainly there are times where I've had patients that come in and they're like, oh, I took all this out of my diet, but I started eating two bananas for breakfast and this and that. It's like, okay, hold on a second. If you were running every morning after that, maybe, but you know, if you're sitting about your day, that might not be so good. But I do think it's interesting. There are studies of populations that are very high carb based on fruit, like in the Amazon area. And those people don't get diabetes, even though all they're eating is carbohydrates. And then there's other groups of people like Alaskan population before more civilization type thing, but they would eat fat all day long and they didn't get heart disease and diabetes either. So much of it, like Lindsay said, comes back to what you're eating and what the natural form is and all of that other piece of inflammation that we may already have baseline in our body from other things and how our body reacts to that. So one of the tools we talk about a lot, and I know Katie's done this personally too, is using a continuous glucose monitor. And so, she's got it on. You got it on right now? Okay, awesome. I have one on my desk that I just have not put on in a while. I need to. I should have done it before I traveled to see like the stress impact. But the continuous glucose monitor measures your interstitial blood sugar. They are not technically approved for not patients without diabetes at this time, but there is a movement in this health and wellness space to use them to monitor and look at how you respond to foods in your diet. So for me, if I ate oatmeal, like my blood sugar would go up to like 150 or 160, but other types of carbohydrates, like even some of the complex grains and other things, then it was fine. So I figured out, okay, oatmeal is not a good choice for me as far as what this does to my blood sugar. And so that's really the cool tool that we have. I do a lot of diabetes management and I love just seeing the light bulb go on when they, you know, I can tell them all day that two bananas at breakfast is going to raise their blood sugar, but until they see it themselves on the machine, like it doesn't matter what I tell them. So I think that's a really great tool. Even if you don't have diabetes, unfortunately they are prescription, but there are a few wellness programs out there that you can order one through that a physician does sign off on a prescription for them. But even if you just did it 2 weeks a year, you know, you picked one of the ones and 10 to 14 days a year, you checked out the different dietary things that you're doing and just sort of keep it in check. That can be a huge help to deciding like how I as an individual respond to these foods, because my husband could eat a bowl of oatmeal and his blood sugar would stay consistent the entire time and probably hardly even spike. And so it's one of those things like, is it maybe got bacteria differences in our microbiome that are affecting that. And I think that that's really some of the cool data that's coming out, is that certain foods have to be broken down into smaller pieces. And those smaller pieces are those chemicals. Some of those chemicals are probably the benefit that we're getting. So some people that say like, you know, the oats are heart healthy, then it could be that the people that aren't getting that benefit maybe are missing that bacteria that does the job to break it down. And other foods, you know, maybe similar things. So if we're missing the microbiome that's helping to digest our foods and putting into these smaller phytonutrients, then we may be missing some of the health benefits. So again, the diversity is key. And we're still on the edge of learning on how to get that back. And there's definitely some interventions that we can do, but it's still a learning process. All right. So what do we eat? We talked about all of those things. We talked about carbs and the inflammation that can go from those highly refined carbs. So Katie, what do we eat?
So I think I like the idea of when you're in the grocery store, trying to spend most of your time on the perimeter, because that's the real food. Most of the stuff in the middle is those food-like substances that try to make these great claims to get you to spend money. There's fiber and there's vitamins. It's like, okay, but you could just have an apple that has all of that in there.
And that inulin fiber that's in that bar, you know, that's going to keep you gassy all day.
Not to name names, but chocolate chips and oats and stuff and syrup.
Right.
You know, and they enrich them with vitamins. So they add vitamins in. Cereal has a ton of vitamins added in, and then it's considered a health food. But vitamins are very complicated, and they work better together when you get them from real food. They work synergistically. Yes. And so that's really important
that
too.
That point is so important. And when we think about the data for like giving individual like vitamin D or vitamin E or vitamin C, is that when we get it from nature, we also get other phytonutrients with that that play all these different roles. And I think that's been a challenge in some of these supplement studies, that one, they're doing maybe really high doses, or one, if they're not showing positive effects, it may be because we're missing those other pieces of those foods.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons too, why it's hard to study nutrition, because they want so badly to just pull one thing out and say, this is what works and this is what doesn't, but it's the whole food of it and focusing on diversity, you know, diversity of plants, like eating the rainbow.
Every eat an day. Apple.
Eat all the colors of apples,
right?
Green, red, yellow, switching it up every week and trying new things, being inclusive, not thinking about what you need to pull out and remove, but thinking more, how much can I add? How can I make my plate look colorful and enjoy it? Not thinking I need to remove everything. And
right. Yeah. I think in functional medicine, particularly, we can get in a trap sometimes of asking people to remove too many foods, or people, they start to have this gut inflammation and they start to react to more and more foods. So they've removed dairy and gluten, and then they're starting to eat other things, and then their body starts to mount an immune response to that. And so we've had patients come in that are eating like three items. They're eating like lettuce and carrots and chicken, like that's all they're eating. And it's like, whoa, we cannot maintain your microbiome diversity with just these three foods. And so it can be a sort of a rabbit trail that people can go down sometimes. Certainly sometimes it may be warranted to give the gut a rest, maybe with certain types of things, but we have to figure out how to get people that diversity back. And that's one of the reasons we've talked about the low FODMAP diet too before, which is a diet that we remove fermentable carbohydrates like onions and garlic and wheat products. And also like fructose can be one of those. And then people feel better because they're not fermenting all this carbs and creating gas, which causes bloating. But then they have to be able to put those back because we need fermentable carbohydrates to grow that bacteria. So it's not intended to be a long-term diet. We have to correct course and introduce those back in after working with a provider, maybe on a protocol. But all right, so let's talk about, as we finish up this discussion, about intermittent fasting. So this is a big thing. And honestly, there's a lot of data in the metabolic syndrome world to support intermittent fasting. So basically, we as humans used to go long periods of time without eating. There would be, you'd be walking between cities, you'd be working out in the fields, you wouldn't have a convenient vending machine right here. Or I think about even traveling. It's like, goodness gracious, we're on a 2-hour flight from Denver to Cincinnati and we've got this meal and we've got... I was in first class because I got upgraded and they're giving you this meal. They're coming by with a snack tray. They're asking you what drinks you want. It's like, oh man, like this is almost 10 o'clock at night now. And I'm just like, there's no reason like I should be eating this food. And we go to conferences too. I was thinking about the conference last week and it's like, yeah, morning break snack and lunch snack and all these things. But that's not how it originally started. And so really today, fasting ideally, we want to at least give our bodies a break for 12 hours. So if we can stop eating at 8 p.m. and not start until 8 a.m. or whether it's 7 p.m. and 7 a.m., whatever that looks like for you. But ideally, we want to give our body a rest. We want to give that gut a rest to recover. The peristalsis process, where our body actually sort of triggers a cleansing wave through the small intestine and starts, you know, the process of motility, essentially, and helping us have those morning bowel movements, comes in that resting period. And so it also helps to lower your insulin resistance and allows us to access some of that fat for fuel, like Lindsay talked about with the keto diet too. It helps us to burn some fat. So there can definitely be, you know, benefits for patients, especially patients that are trying to lose a lot of weight and extending that fasting period. There's actually some interesting evidence in longevity and actually the telomere length, which is one of the measurements that we can look at for longevity, that the longer fasting periods actually help improve that. So some people will go up to 16 hours and have like an 8-hour window of eating. So certainly this could be something good for people. And sometimes we see programs that mix this with carb cycling, where some days they might do a more intense workout that they do low carbs, so they burn their fat, and then they might do a muscle building exercise that another day they're doing more of those complex carbs, the carbs that we consider maybe more healthy, and fruits and those starchy things, to be able to help rebuild their muscles and give their body the nutrients that they need. So I don't necessarily think intermittent fasting is bad for most people that are healthy, but where, and I want Lindsay to talk about this a little bit, but where it comes into a concern is a lot of people our age that are in their 20s and 30s and that are super stressed out, that their body starts this and they have their cortisol just gets sort of out of whack. So Lindsay, maybe you can even tell your story too, if you want, a little bit about how you felt better after incorporating those carbs back in.
Yeah, I think any type of, I guess I'll call it food rules. And in the case of intermittent fasting, it's like you can stop eating at this time and you start eating at this time. Any type of food rules, I think when taken too far, isn't a good thing. And it kind of disconnects us from our bodies in a way where we just completely stop listening to them. And in my case, I was doing, I would say, like a small version of intermittent fasting. I wasn't going like the 16 hours like a lot of people do. It was close to 12 hours, but I was getting up really early. And so it would probably be 3 hours I would be up before I would eat for the day. And I would be so hungry, but I wasn't listening to my body because I couldn't eat until 8 a.m., right? And that, I think, added extra stress on top, like that physical stress, to where my blood sugar regulation was just out of control, up and down. Cortisol was spiking. Cortisol was making my blood sugar even worse. And it just was a recipe for disaster in my case. And I was also limiting carbs at the time, which obviously is going to make my blood sugar go crazy as well. And so listening to my body, eating when I was hungry, putting back some carbs, good quality carbs in the form of the starchy vegetables and more fruit, really helped me to balance my blood sugar. And another thing I did want to say about balancing blood sugar is food pairing is huge with that as well. Like, we don't want to just be eating carbs by themselves. If we can pair our carbs with a protein and or a fat and fiber, that's really going to help keep our blood sugar level a lot more stable, which is what we want. We can have our carbs, but I think we do need to be mindful of what else we're eating with our carbs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was actually a study that took patients that ate, they had a salad and a hamburger. So one group of patients ate the hamburger bun first, and then ate the salad and the hamburger patty. And then another group of patients ate them together, the burger patty with the bun and the salad, sort of all at the same time. And then another group of patients ate just the hamburger. Let's see, what should I say? I said the carb already first, the the patty and the salad and then ate the bun. And the people that ate the bun last had the lowest glucose exposure. So they had less of the high blood sugars afterwards when they waited like 15 minutes after eating their protein. And probably part of that is your digestive enzymes are flowing, that GLP-1 response is starting, we're starting to get the insulin release. And so then when we ate that carb, everything was already going. So the group that ate it together was also better than the group that ate the bun first by itself. So it does really mean a lot when we the timing of it and also having the protein with it as well. So that's a really important point to bring out. And so with the intermittent fasting piece, we're not saying that it's bad for everybody, but there are people that have psychological tendencies to go more extreme with certain things than other things. And sometimes I agree, Lindsay, like thinking about your body and if you're hungry, like eating when your body needs fuel. I mean, we monitor our sleep nowadays with trackers like Oura rings and Whoop bands and things like that. And we want to look at those results and do something about it. But the same thing, like it's telling us that our body maybe didn't get the rest we need or had a really intense workout. And so when you have those days where you're having a more intense workout or you're more stressed or things are going on, there may be a need for more food or more different types of calories. And so we have to react to that. I know if I am doing any kind of cycling or like intense cardio, that the next day I'm like starving because my body's like, oh my goodness, I used a lot of effort yesterday. I need you to replenish that. So I think, yeah, making sure you're listening to your body can be huge. And if you are in a place where you have blood sugars that are out of control or you have stress hormones that are out of control, definitely working with a provider, whether it's one of our farm to table team or your own provider, to just really have this conversation. And unfortunately, this nutrition information is not something that is discussed very well in medical school curriculum or even pharmacy school curriculum. Most of us figured this out on sort of our own journey into this functional integrative medicine space. So definitely finding the person that can treat you as an individual. And one of the other cool tools in this space is nutrigenomics. So we can actually check your DNA and there's data to connect like different SNPs, which are changes in your DNA from original patterns that are associated with maybe poor fat metabolism or poor carbohydrate intolerance or more likelihood to have magnesium deficiency. So there can be ways you can use just your individual information as sort of a way to navigate what dietary choices are the best. But I think no matter what you choose, the core really is still going to be that anti-inflammatory oils, the non-starchy vegetables, the colorful fruits and vegetables, and making sure you're getting that. Like we didn't mention the carnivore diet, but somehow I just don't even know how that's a thing for people just to eat meat constantly, especially in this day and age. You know, I just like, how did they get there? I mean, I realize their blood sugars are probably okay, but you know, their microbiome is not. So, and there was also last week in the conference that I was at, I was talking about GI integrative medicine module, and there's data looking at fiber supplementation versus like food fibers. And there is better results in microbiome diversity when we get the food fibers. And probably going back to what Katie was talking about, and that we're getting the whole plant, we're getting all these different pieces and these different types of fiber, and the phytonutrients and how they affect the microbiome are also, those colorful pieces of the puzzle are also playing a role there. And we can do whole food-based fiber powders and things like that for people that maybe need some extra support when they're healing their gut, but we can't skip out on the dietary piece. We can't just supplement the fiber and expect that we're going to get all the health benefits that we would have got with the food. So I think we said a lot, but I think our biggest thing is going back to the basics and filling those plates with non-starchy vegetables, a little bit of carbs, a little bit of protein and fat, and not stressing about it. Because you're right, Lindsay, like stressing makes it so much worse. I know when I was going through sort of my health crisis that led me down the functional medicine path, I was one day doing, we didn't even talk about this, but like the SCD diet and the GAPS diet. And the more things I remove, the more stress I was about it. And it just gets your body into this fight or flight stage, which is not helpful in your healing process and probably more detrimental than that food that you would have eaten intuitively that felt good to eat in that moment. So anything else you guys want to add?
I just wanted to mention too, like with the IF, you know, intermittent fasting and paying attention to your hunger scale. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great tool to use where you are actually paying attention to, am I hungry? Why am I eating? Is it boredom? Am I buffering? Mm-hmm. something? Is it stress? I think that is a huge piece in people who are struggling to lose weight and just kind of getting your mind in tune with your eating is a big piece of it. And that's where a health coach can help, mm-hmm. you know, and we have those on the team.
Yes.
And yeah, I think that's a big part of it as well.
Yeah. And too, like we know if you don't sleep well, that your leptin and some of those hormones that trigger your hunger can actually be higher the next day. So those days that you don't get enough sleep, you'll notice that you're also more hungry. So there's a lot going back to, we say we talk about stress on the podcast all the time, and we do because it's so important. And the stress reduction in the sleep, there's some people that I'm like, I'm not going to get you better until I can get you sleeping at least 7 hours a night. And it's not for that we're not doing all the other right things, but that sleep and restorative period for your hormone reset and your whole body to do that cleansing process is so important for that rest and your brain, especially for the neuro regeneration. So if your patients aren't sleeping, you have to fix that. That's another thing if you're a healthcare provider looking at this. So awesome. Anything else you want to add, Lindsay?
I would just say if you're looking to start somewhere, just challenge yourself to eat the rainbow every day. Yeah. Try to get something of every color every day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Awesome. All righty. Well, thank you guys for joining me. This was a great discussion. I really feel like we sort of took the historical piece and brought in, you know, what America looks like today and how we can move forward. But it's exciting to see so many people interested in nutrition and getting back to the foundation. Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.